You know, I'll never forget my old dad. When these things would happen to him, the things he'd say to me.
What did he say?
What the hell are you doing in the bathroom day and night? Why don't you get out of there? Give someone else a chance.
It's pronounced Funkenstein on the Cut Print Film Podcast, episode 38. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave, and Chris.
Oh, hello. I didn't see you there. Welcome to the Cut Print Film Podcast, episode 38. I'm Chris Evangelista.
I'm Jeff Rollins.
And I'm Dave Costell.
Hey, guys, what are we?
We're bringing you the hits.
No, we're not. We are a movie podcast, and we talk about movies and directors and actors and all sorts of things like that.
All that silly goose stuff.
Yes.
And if you're feeling particularly crazy, why not go on to iTunes and give our podcast a rating?
Yes, preferably of the five-star variety.
Yes.
We don't need any more one-star rating.
And if you write a funny enough review, we might just read it on air. You never know.
Or yeah. We might ignore it forever.
Probably.
And just tweet us too. Be like, hey, at Cut Print Film, what's your favorite movie?
Yeah, anything like that. Yeah. We'll certainly get a response or a rise out of me.
The more general question, the better.
You can also check out our website, cutprintfilm.com. That's where we put all our movie reviews, editorials. We do interviews with directors and actors and all sorts of people.
And we recently had a big redesign on the site. And not to toot our own horn, but it looks really good.
Toot.
Yeah, we sent the site into the gym. It pumped for a couple weeks. Yeah. Came back
looking great.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got great traps.
Well, it was trap day every day.
All right, so what are we talking about today, gentlemen?
I heard a really, really good movie came out this week.
Oh, what's it called?
Dumb and Dumber 2.
Oh, well, then you will be mistaken, because on cutprintfilm.com, I gave the film a 0 out of 10.
Isn't that our first 0
it
rating?
Is. The lowest film before this was Sabotage, which got a 1.
And you also reviewed that.
I did, so lucky me. And
so
let's just say...
Right now it's Dumb and Dumber... what was that movie? Sabotage and then RoboCop. They're the three worst.
That's 0, 1, and 2. They're our lowest rated films.
And I'll just say, I didn't go into this movie... I went into the movie expecting it to be bad, but I would have been thrilled if it hadn't been bad. Because
you went in set to give it about a 3 or 4, probably.
Yeah, I was like, this will probably get a 5, maybe, but it was much worse than I thought it was going
to
be.
I was expecting you to go in and come out being like, that wasn't that bad.
That's
like,
what usually happens.
Yeah.
Because I went in to see Horrible Bosses 2 expecting nothing, and I actually really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I saw the trailer for that, and I was like, it doesn't look too bad.
It wasn't, but...
But the trailer for Dumb and Dumber 2.
The trailer for Dumb and Dumber 2 is atrocious.
Yeah, we should probably start there. I remember
you want me to play the trailer?
Please don't ever play the trailer for me. I just remember when that hit the internet and...
Ow.
It hit the internet at 75 miles an hour.
In the gut.
And people just started posting it on Facebook saying, oh, yes, can't wait. Because it was Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels... And the Farrelly brothers, or Farrelly, however you want to say it.
The Scolari brothers,
it was
I believe,
not, it
from
was not,
Ghostbusters 2.
It certainly was not the Scolari brothers. I believe the judge gave them the chair. The Farrelly brothers are back to direct, and pretty much everybody's back that was any significant part of the film. And
right.
So fans of the first film were excited because that Dumb and Dumber, when Harry Met Lloyd prequel from... I think, what was that, 2006
or so?
Oh
my God, I forgot about that.
That's a movie everyone forgot about.
And rightfully so, because it was panned by critics. Audiences hated it. But everybody was so excited when this trailer came out, and I thought, did I watch the same trailer as these people?
I guess it's just a nostalgia thing. That's the only thing I could think of, because, I mean, when I look back at the first film, I still enjoy it.
I do, too.
It's a funny movie, and I don't know, it's... There's something innocent about that movie, I guess. It's like before.
It's goofy.
Yeah.
It's a goofy, dumb movie. And I like the Farrelly brothers. I love Kingpin. I like Me, Myself, and Irene.
You're the one person who likes
I like Me, Myself, and Irene,
I think
too.
That's a funny movie with his dual personality with Hank.
I didn't like that, but I do think Kingpin is great. Kingpin is
their best film.
I would say so. Yeah.
It's almost like it doesn't belong with the others. Yeah, it's so good.
It's like a disgusting 70s film, but we're getting off topic. And there's something about Mary, of course. Everybody enjoyed that when it came out. But this movie, oh my God, what the hell happened to all these? Everybody involved is just slumming it.
It's bad. So since I saw the film, I'll give you guys a breakdown of it, or you could read my review at cutprintfilm.com.
Please do read it. It's one of my favorite things we've ever posted.
So the film picks up 20 years since the first film, because 20 years have passed, and
which the trailer gives away.
Yeah.
When he rips the catheter out. Yeah. We just laugh.
I'm not going to do a detailed breakdown of this movie, because that would just be... my fucking brain would slide out of my mouth as I talk. But so basically, Harry and Lloyd... Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels, they're still buddies, they're still idiots, and Harry, Jeff Daniels' character, says, oh, he needs a new kidney, and Lloyd isn't a match for him, or something like that. Right. It's not really, they don't do enough effort into the story. So Harry discovers that he has a daughter, and the daughter was given up for adoption, so...
Who was the mother of the daughter? I believe she's referenced from the first film.
Oh, I forget her.
I have her name. Oh. It's Freda Felcher.
Okay, there you go. So Freda Felcher, who is played by Kathleen Turner in this film, who, man, she does not aged well. And I think she actually has like medical problems, and that's the reason.
Yeah.
Good job making fun of her.
I'm not making fun of her. Well, as much as I can make fun of her, it wouldn't be anywhere near how much the movie makes fun of her appearance. Oh, good.
So it's in poor taste.
Oh, literally every time she's on screen, someone's pointing out how hideous she is. They're just so... So Harry and Lloyd, they go on a road trip basically to find Harry's daughter, to get her to donate a kidney to Harry.
Can I cut to the chase and ask a question?
Sure,
please. Does he really not need a new kidney?
Yes, that's the twist. The twist is he does not need a new kidney. Also, the twist is that... it's not really his daughter, which I'm pretty sure everyone could have fucking guessed going into the film.
Well, I couldn't guess it, and I also couldn't fucking care less. God, who cares? Who cares about... Did we need a sequel?
No, we didn't. And the thing that struck me about this movie the most, other than how terrible it was, is it's really, really mean. And it's almost obnoxiously mean. Like, the first movie, it has... dark stuff in it, like, you know, the bird getting its head ripped off and stuff like that. But all the stuff that happens that's bad, it's done by the bad guy characters in that first movie. And even when Harry and Lloyd in the first film, they were causing trouble, they were oblivious to the trouble. They were just, because they're idiots. That was sort of the joke.
Aside from Lloyd pouring the KO pectate into Harry's coffee and giving him that hilarious diarrhea.
And but like, even that is, there's sort of a stupid innocence to that.
It's a juvenile prank.
Right. So it's like, even when they were doing bad stuff in the first movie, you could sort of shrug it off as like, they're idiots. But this sequel is just insanely, especially Jim Carrey's character, he's Lloyd. He's just mean to everyone. And I was like, it's almost like the Farrelly brother, where the hell did I pronounce their name? They didn't watch the first movie when they wrote this script. They were just like, they were sort of like, we're winging it. They were like, I guess they're mean. I can't remember. Let's just make them mean. And
do they put another shrimp on the Barbie?
No, they don't do that.
Hey, how many jokes are revisited?
I will say, I was expecting literally every fucking joke from the first movie to just be rehashed. They don't actually do that. So
I'm actually shocked.
I am. So I think I'm trying to. They do the fucking I like it a lot joke, but they only do it once. I was expecting them to do that like 20 times in the film. And they have characters who reappear. Like Seabass, that guy's back.
Does he talk with his asshole?
That's not the same movie.
It's a different franchise.
But there actually are a plethora of scenes where both Harry and Lloyd are shoving their asses.
Yeah, you're thinking of the number 23.
Yeah, that's right.
You're thinking of Batman Forever. The Riddler ass riddles from his ass.
Riddle me this.
He farts.
I would have watched a sequel if it was like the two of them in jail on life sentences for some creepy charges.
What?
That's like a really hardcore movie of them.
Well, that's the other thing. So, when Lloyd gets a glimpse of Harry's daughter, like a photo of her, he acts like a fucking cartoon wolf, basically.
He's a Tex Avery wolf.
Yeah, and he spends the whole movie fantasizing about banging her, and he's, you know, Jim Carrey is in his, like, 50s now, and the actress is supposed to be 20-something. It just comes across as really creepy and unsettling, and it just bothered me. I don't know. I don't know. And, like, I saw it in the theater with a preview audience, and a lot of people there were laughing their asses off, and I was just I sat there stone faced, and I was just like, "Is the problem me? Am I taking this too seriously? I don't."
No, because I remember seeing trailers for it and having the same thing happen. Like people would just be dying laughing, and I'm looking over at Sam, like, "What's happening?"
That's what I was saying about the trailer and people posting it on Facebook, saying, "Oh, I can't wait for this." And I watched the trailer, and I have not seen that many jokes bomb in a row since like visiting an '80s. Gallagher VHS tape.
Like a Sinbad stand-up.
Where the humor just stinks and the delivery is so forced. That trailer was terrible, and I knew that movie was going to be bad, but it's number one at the box office this week.
Is it like people younger than us who didn't see Dumb and Dumber?
No, because the people in this audience I was with, they were probably my age or older, and they were all like... Well, let me just say this screening was hosted by WMMR, who can fucking jump up my butt. And so the audience was MMR fans who can fucking...
They were only there for the free t-shirt.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, was anyone shooting t-shirts at them?
There was a nice trivia. I don't know how many of our listeners...
Here's an extra large!
I don't know how many of our listeners have been to advanced screenings of things, so... But a lot of times, advanced screenings, they're sort of joint hosted by marketing companies and also radio companies give away contests. So, unfortunately, this was a radio contest screening, and at the beginning, they asked Dumb and Dumber trivia, and people got t-shirts, and I don't know. I just sit there, and I'm just like, can we watch the fucking movie? I don't care.
Well, that's the other thing. This film screened... for the first and only time 2 days before it was released wide. That is always a bad sign. Whenever we get our list of screenings and we see that its only screening is 2 days before the premiere. Yeah,
or even the night before.
Yeah,
like
know we are in Dutch.
Yeah, that's...
it's not going to be good.
That's never a good sign. But this movie, I guess it's critic-proof because critics did not like... No, some critics liked it, which boggles my goddamn mind.
Yeah, I have a few quotes here. Okay. Matt Singer from Screen Crush, formerly of The Dissolve.
Who we all love, Matt Singer.
Yeah, we love Matt Singer. He's usually got his finger on the pulse here.
Yeah.
His pull quote is, "stupendously stupid." And that's a positive term. Right. He gave this a good review, 3.5 stars out of 5. The Guardian, Jordan Hoffman from The Guardian, which is a major, major international newspaper, said, "I'd be lying if I said this movie didn't crack me up on more than a few occasions."
I don't get it.
And finally, Ty Burr from the Boston Globe said, "Everyone has piled into this dumber, sillier, more consistently funny reprise with an enthusiasm that's infectious."
What?
I don't get that at all.
What an asshole. Jim Carrey, I like Jim Carrey. I'll always like Jim Carrey, but I feel like it's been so long since he's done this type of like goofy rubber face role. He doesn't know how to do it anymore. Like what used to come so naturally to him back in the day, it seems really forced and painful to watch now.
Here's the crazy thing. I watched the incredible Burt Wonderstone a couple weeks ago, and he is consistently the best part of that movie. And he's only in it a few times, but he's the funniest part, and he's doing that goofy cartoon character type role. He has airbrushed on abs. he's funny in that movie. So to see him in these trailers, because again, I have not seen this film, Dumb and Dumber 2, he looks like he is just phoning it in and having a miserable time. Nobody looks like they're having any fun.
No, I felt bad just because like there's like in that first movie, I remember they had a nice sort of silly chemistry with each other. There's nothing like that in this movie. They seem like strangers.
You get that from the trailer. Yeah,
so I don't get it.
Jeff Daniels too. Like I feel like he's gone too serious, and it's like seeing him back in a comedic role.
Well, he was
role,
a serious actor when the first it was a weird casting choice in the first one. That's why it was so surprising that it worked.
Yeah, that's sort of what made the first film effective, is that you had a comedy guy like Jim Carrey bouncing off a more serious actor doing comedy.
Yeah, because there was an SNL skit of all the Jim Carrey. Did you see that one?
No.
When Jim Carrey was on there, it was Jim Carrey at a Jim Carrey reunion, and all of the Jim Carrey characters start showing up, and then Jeff Daniels did a cameo as Lloyd.
I'm sure that was
Jim Carrey's character, right?
I'm sure that was leaps and bounds funnier.
Jim Carrey is Lloyd.
Yeah, Lloyd Christmas.
So Jeff Daniels shows up as Lloyd.
No. And, oh, I gotcha.
Yeah, and it was just like, it was It was not
meta.
Funny.
Was it too meta?
It just wasn't funny. I'm like, oh, this is weird. Like, this movie's not going to be good just that's based on this skit alone.
That skit alone sounds better than the entire movie.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, because fucking Bobby Moynihan is dressed up as the Mask and he's smoking. He's smoking indoors. And they're like, you can't smoke in here. And he's like, somebody stop me.
Oh, boy.
It's fucking great.
So yeah, Dumb and Dumber 2, I think it earned every point it got from you, which is zero.
I mean, I guess I get why it's number one at the box office.
The direction's very bad. Sorry.
It's terrible. It's all point and shoot. There's one scene I pointed out in my review that is actually well-filmed and funny where it's shot where, I don't want to explain the whole scene, but it's basically someone getting hit by a train, and the way it's filmed is actually legitimately funny. The rest of the movie around it is so bad that this scene jarred me because it was so well done.
Hey, where did this humor and charm come from?
Yeah, I was
from?
Like, what? Like, oh.
They outsourced it.
Maybe the second unit director took over for that day. I don't know, but.
The direction's bad, but this is the Farrelly brothers' biggest box office opening. And it's Jim Carrey's biggest box office opening in over 10 years. His last biggest opening was Bruce Almighty in 2003, and that was a mega hit.
Oh my god!
Yeah,
that was a long time ago too. Mm-hmm.
That just makes me a little sad because
$38 million, number one at the box office.
Because I just remember that stretch of period where Jim Carrey just kept trying to make somewhat quality films, and no one cared. Then he just does this, and everyone runs to see it.
And he made some really good films.
Absolutely. I mean, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is, I would say, his best film.
It's yeah,
great.
Without a doubt.
Truman Show, that's great.
Yeah, I love the Truman Show. And it's just no one cared. And now he makes this, and people just run.
Yeah, all he needs to do now is, like you said, talk with his asshole.
I'm sure Ace Ventura 3 will be coming any day now.
It's a depressing week for that to do so well, too, because I was hoping for Interstellar to get an uptick, you know? It's just a bit of a boost, but...
Push down that in Big Hero 6.
Yeah.
It's just... But it's just instilling this horrible movie factor, because studio execs see this and they're like, oh, let's make The Mask 3, and
it sucks.
It's just that's the way it is. It's people, you don't, this is legitimate proof that you don't need quality to be successful. Just throw a bunch of shit that's recognizable up on the screen and people will run to it.
Yeah, I heard one of the Farrelly brothers. Is that how you say it? Farrelly,
we don't know.
I think it's the Fuckface brothers. Yes. I'll call them.
He was on I guess it was Ron Bennington's show on Mast, and he was talking about how he kept reading this script to his stoner friends, and they would die laughing.
Oh, well.
So over the 20 years, they would keep begging him to read them the script while they were high, and he's like, I just knew I had to make it because they wouldn't stop laughing. And you said it just...
might be the opposite of what I'd gauge my screenwriting prowess on.
I will say that I can imagine if you were really... If you were stoned out of your mind, you would probably find this film funny. Because it's all really dumb humor about farts and stuff like that. And I guess if you're stoned, you're going to...
Yeah, but you probably find Blood Diamond funny, too, if you were stoned.
Well, Diamond is hilarious.
What's that stoner movie that came out a few years ago?
You're really
Grandma's Boy?
It's about weed.
Oh, Your Highness?
Oh,
no. No.
The one with Dave
Pineapple Express?
Thinking, right?
Pineapple Express is what I'm talking
about. I'm going way back.
That's a stoner film, but that is actually funny because there's jokes. There's funny dialogue. There's rapid-fire humor. This looked like gross-out gags, one after the next.
I'll point out the biggest quote-unquote gag in this film involves a scene where at one point Harry loses his hearing, and so Lloyd's idea is, let's go to a nursing home and steal hearing aids so you can hear better, which I guess that's
what I would do.
That's somewhat funny, I guess. So they go to the nursing home, and in the process of looking for hearing aids, Lloyd ends up fingering a old woman in her bed.
That's what I would do.
And then when he pulls his finger out of her, he blows on it and dust blows off the finger.
All right.
And literally everyone in the theater I was with groaned, and it wasn't a good, like, oh, that's a funny... I could tell everyone hated this joke. So.
I'm so angry, I just squeezed a cue ball and it crushed in the white powder.
In your teeth.
But first time where the comedy generation, the generation of comedians isn't handing movies off to the next one? They're just refusing to die? That's what it seems like.
No, it happens. I mean... Look at Charlie Chaplin. He made films into like well past silent film era.
Yeah.
But someone like we're talking about today, Gene Wilder, he just hung it up. You know what I mean?
That's true. But I mean, his wife died of cancer. I mean,
yeah, I believe she watched Dumb and Dumber 2 and then passed away.
All right. Well, Richard Pryor, he's not doing movies anymore.
Well, he's dead.
he also died, yeah. Dave.
He set himself on fire.
Dave, are you all right? Are you dying?
How come there aren't any new Fatty Arbuckle films?
Oh, boy.
And Bill Cosby, you don't hear about him anymore.
Yeah, what's he up to?
I'll be honest, I don't want to talk about him at all.
All right, so we just talked about Dumb and Dumber for 20 minutes.
That's upsetting. I wish we hadn't.
And does that T.O. annoy the shit out of you in the title?
Well, see, it's funny because they're dumb.
Yeah, you don't remember Dumb and Dumber. Yeah, you don't put an E-R after an E-R.
Can we stop with the gag titles?
No, I love them.
Okay.
No, we'll never stop.
I just love them.
All right, where are we going next?
We're making the triumphant return to our director series.
What is that? I've never heard of this thing before.
Uh-oh, Dave had a stroke.
That is where we discuss three film. We watch and then discuss three films from a director's oeuvre.
And, the director's Ooga Booga,
yes,
I believe.
His Ooga Booga.
And then we judge them? Is it like Top Chef?
No, we don't judge them. We just have a discussion.
On the chopping block?
It's spanned over three episodes. So this is the first episode of our Mel Brooks director series that we've been teasing for 17 months.
Also, I just went to look up Mel Brooks and I accidentally typed Mel Gibson, so...
It's the same thing.
Sorry, guys. We're going to have to end the show early tonight.
This is our director series on Mel Brooks.
Hey.
Director series.
That's it. I think that's enough. They've heard enough.
Yeah.
I agree with you, self.
Past Jeff.
Younger Jeff.
Oh. A little production there. Okay.
Just some editing on the fly.
So... today we're talking about Mel Brooks' 1974 film Young Frankenstein.
Hell yeah.
Do we have a little write-up on Mel Brooks?
I
anybody
do.
Wants to read?
I've got something right here that I wrote myself and did not get from Wikipedia. Mel Brooks is an American film director, screenwriter, composer, lyricist, comedian, actor, and producer. He is best known as a creator of broad film farces and comic parodies. He began his career as a stand-up comic and a writer for the early TV variety show Your Show of Shows with Sid Caesar. He became well-known as part of the comedy duo with Carl Reiner, the 2,000-year-old man. In middle age, he became one of the most successful film directors of the 1970s, with many of his films being among the top 10 moneymakers of the year that they were released. And his most well-known films include The Producers, The 12 Chairs, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, High Anxiety, History of the World Part 1, Spaceballs, and of course, Robin Hood, Men in Tights. He was also married to actress Anne Bancroft until she passed away in 2005.
Right.
And he's still alive. He's still ticking that, Mel Brooks.
Kicking. He is old. How old is he?
He is 830 years old.
He's from the Old Testament.
He is 88.
Mel Brooks also produced a film from our director series, The Fly.
He did.
By David Cronenberg. Yeah. So he had his hands in all kinds of shit.
And he still does. Mel Brooks is a genius. Let's just get that out there.
Yeah. And he'll live forever, apparently. He solved the mystery of death. Yes. That's how smart he is.
He doesn't look like he solved the mystery of death. But,
well, yeah. But I believe he got cursed by a cave troll. But
he's still kicking.
He is.
And yeah, he's a genius. He's pretty much just a producer now.
Right.
He's got his hand on everything.
Is he the producer?
He's not the producer. No. Stop it. Doing that noise.
I wish everyone at home could have seen Dave's face as he was doing it.
He put on a Matthew Broderick mask. It was weird.
So what's your favorite Mel Brooks movie?
Personally, wow. Maybe Blazing Saddles?
Okay, yeah. I'm partial to Robin Hood Men in Tights. A ridiculous movie.
I really do hate that movie.
Yeah.
My favorite Mel Brooks movie is tonight's movie, Young Frankenstein.
Awesome. Awesome.
Okay, so
Dracula Dead and Loving It.
Hey, don't worry, we'll be doing that one.
Let's just say I actually enjoyed Dracula Dead and Loving It when I saw it.
I've never
as
seen
a young
it.
Kid.
I can't wait to see it. 2 weeks. Okay, so this was Young Frankenstein came out in 1974. It was directed by Mel Brooks, who As we said, did Spaceballs, Producers, Blazing Saddles. It stars Gene Wilder as Dr. Frankenstein.
Another genius, Gene Wilder, not Dr. Frankenstein.
Yes.
I guess he is a genius too. But
correct. He has all those Tesla coils.
Is he really the Ween Wilder?
No, Ween Wilder is no relation.
Okay.
Also starring Marty Feldman as Igor, Madeline Kahn, Terry Garr, Cloris Leachman, Peter Boyle, Gene Hackman.
Yes, and Kenneth Mars.
Yes.
As Inspector Kemp.
We'll talk about Inspector
Kemp. You don't like Inspector Kemp?
No.
I love Inspector Kemp.
Let's get to him in a bit.
All right.
I'll read a synopsis. In this spoof of Mary Shelley's Gothic tale, the grandson of Victor Frankenstein, a neurosurgeon, has spent his life living down the legend of his grandfather, even changing the pronunciation of his name. When he discovers his grandfather's diary, he begins to feel differently and returns to the family castle to satisfy his curiosity by replicating his ancestors' experiments. In the process, he creates one very unique monster. And that's the synopsis. That's a basic...
Sounds scary.
Oh, it isn't.
So, apparently Gene Wilder pitched this to Mel Brooks, saying like, oh, I wanted to make a story where Frankenstein wanted nothing to do with his family and was ashamed of it.
Yeah, he was actually writing it on the set of Blazing Saddles.
Yeah, and that's a funny premise, but it immediately falls away within like the first...
Yeah.
15 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, so, I think
it just turns into Frankenstein.
Yeah, I think it's just, it was needed to get the story going, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, this is essentially the Frankenstein story retold as a, from a comedic perspective. That's fine.
Yeah, it's a spoof of the Universal horror films, especially Son of Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Which this borrows heavily from, including the Inspector Kemp character, which is everyone's favorite character, apparently.
No, not in this room.
Can we talk about first, like, how Mel Brooks directed the shit out of this thing?
Oh,
like,
it's a gorgeous movie.
It is
beautiful.
It's exactly beautiful. It looks like a Universal monster film from the 30s.
Right.
To a T.
Except they do close-ups, which is not a thing they really did back then. But everything is handheld camera. There's nothing's on a Steadicam. Nothing's on a dolly. It's all handheld, so you get that shaky quality. Which is, it just looks gorgeous, and it's filmed in true black and white.
And I almost said Mel Gibson again. What's wrong with me? Mel Brooks went out, and he found the guy who basically created all the equipment for the original Frankenstein and got it for this film.
Yeah.
Because his name was Kenneth Strickfaden.
I saw that in the credits.
And Kenneth Strickfaden, he basically still had all this equipment in his garage. Like, he just kept it from the set of the Frankenstein
and
films.
We're talking about the stuff that Dr. Frankenstein used to make the monster.
Yeah, all
like the Tesla coils.
Yeah, all the generic bubbling. Buzzing electrical equipment. And this guy just had it in his garage still. And Mel Brooks just found him and just used it for the film.
Which just gives it that air of authenticity.
Right.
And it looks so good. Even though it's so old and this equipment really does nothing.
Yeah, it just sparks, basically. Yeah.
And I can't really speak to the scientific usage of this equipment. But it's just so neat that he was able to get... Yeah, I'm no scientist. it's just so neat that he was able to get all the original props from those old Universal films.
What about the sets? Was it filmed on any of the old sets? I think it was just
the sets they built, but they looked... great.
Everything looks fantastic.
There's a lot of use of matte painting, which I love because they don't do that anymore because everything now is digital. But I love matte paintings because there's something.
Who's Matt?
He's the guy who paints all the matte paintings. That's why they're called that. There's something like magical about matte paintings because you can always tell they're paintings, but it still just looks cool because there's an amount. We've talked about this before that there's this amount of artistry that goes into creating this, whereas now it's just. I typed this up, and now like there's
that's
a landscape.
Beautiful, Chris.
Yeah, great work.
Yeah, thanks.
Great art.
Well, that's one of the things that made Star Wars so cool was the matte paintings.
Yeah, and just all those older movies that when they just use matte paint, and well, early Spielberg films use them too. And
yeah, I just want to say right off the bat, we said the film looks great. We said
was that a joke? Like a bat? Like right off the bat?
No, it was not. We said the film looked great. We said it was directed. Like spectacularly, Gene Wilder is just fantastic.
Oh my god,
great!
He's just the best thing about this film, and this is a good film. But Gene Wilder, even I mean, he's the star, but he really is the star.
One of my favorite scenes is the first scene with Gene Wilder when he's in the classroom.
Yeah. Just,
and it's a total serious scene. There's not many jokes in that scene.
There's so many scenes in this film that I guess you could call them serious, and they just weren't. The scene where he's creating the monster for the first time, he's rising up, and he's giving that speech.
Yeah.
He's like, the first protozoan.
Yeah. When the slime leaped into man.
And it's
like,
such a great... What makes the... And it's what sort of makes the whole film unique and the performance is that it's never tongue-in-cheek. It's never winking at the audience.
Never.
And that's what I think sets us apart from a lazy sort of parody film, in that it's parodying with love. It's like, they care about what they're trying to do, and that's it makes it unique.
It's a good point. Like, they're actually trying to tell the story of Frankenstein.
If you compare this parody film to, say, the modern Scary Movie parodies, which are just atrocious, where
all those films do is reference things verbatim.
Exactly.
They reference pop culture word for word,
yeah,
commercials even, just to say, hey, remember this commercial? And then they just spew it back to you, and you're like, I do remember that commercial. This is funny.
And they add a cock or something.
There's no art involved in it. And this film is a film about artistry. It's about filmmaking. There's an actual effort put into this.
There's heart.
Yeah.
There's heart to this film.
This is a real movie.
And it's brains.
Yes, there are brains.
Yes.
And an enormous schwatze. Gene Wilder, he's really good, obviously, at going from 0 to 100 in about 2 seconds. And just the inflections in his voice kills me every time.
He spends almost this entire film yelling.
Yeah, screaming.
Yeah.
Is there a modern equivalent of Gene Wilder? Just somebody who's that verbose and just such a presence
in a
movie?
He was a unique actor. He's just a unique performer.
I can't think of anyone who could just
maybe
get away with
Michael
screaming.
Michael Shannon?
I mean,
he's not a comedic actor, but he can be.
He
does have that quiet, manic.
Yeah.
And there's something comedic about
his delivery.
Yeah, and his screaming tone in Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah.
That's close.
Specific scene in Young Frankenstein that illustrates Gene Wilder's brilliance at delivering, going from calm to just out of his mind.
I know what scene
that kills me, and I have it right here.
Let me out of here. Get me the hell out of here. What's the matter with you people? I was joking. Don't you know a joke when you hear one? Jesus Christ, get me out of here. Open this goddamn door. I'll kick your rotten heads in. Mommy!
That scene had me crying.
Oh, it's so good.
And it has me crying now. I absolutely love that. It may be one of my favorite Gene Wilder scenes.
I was thinking of the scene where he sat Igor down after. He's like, oh, sit down. And he just fucking snaps on him. He's like, so did
the
you
Abby
get the
normal scene? Yeah. Abby somebody.
Oh, man. Yeah, so, I mean, we could just list funny scenes in this film.
Yeah.
But,
which we're going to do right after this.
Oh.
Was that an abrupt stop to the conversation?
Yes, it was.
Oh, I guess we have a break coming.
It was like shooting me while eating a big kahuna burger.
Say what again?
Ah, come forth and let me tell you the tale of cutprintfilm.com, a film review, editorial, and news website.
Have they got any loot there?
They do. Oh, I can't find it. Does anyone know where the loot is?
I have one right here.
Cutprint Film has a merry band of men.
Do they drop the beat?
Yes, they do! It includes More Like Radio, Joystick Jerks, and Anti-Fanboy.
Lemons, lemons, lemons.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Putting on the Ritz.
Oh, yeah.
Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes and cutaway coat, perfect fit.
Filled in Frankenstein's.
Putting on the Ritz.
How was this ever a hit? I don't understand.
We're just three guys hanging out listening to Putting on the Ritz.
None of us have shirts on.
We all have spot. I blew that.
That's my favorite part of the song, when the robot comes in. All right, well, that is obviously calling back to the scene where Gene Wilder
where we list our favorite songs.
Where Gene Wilder and the Frankenstein monster, played by Peter Boyle, are dancing and singing to Putting on the Ritz, which is another iconic scene.
That's probably the most famous scene from this film.
So, aside from Gene Wilder, there are some phenomenal performances in this.
There are.
Do you want to?
The obvious next step would be Marty Feldman as Igor, who is just great.
And also steals every scene.
Oh, yeah. He's just the way he looks is enough to make you laugh. So.
This movie doesn't exist without Marty Feldman.
No, it doesn't.
Like, it doesn't hit at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I said Gene Wilder is the major star in this, and he's the best, but Marty Feldman has the highest ratio of jokes that hit their mark every time.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of bombs in this film. Like most Mel Brooks films, there's joke after joke after joke. And a lot of these jokes, like Chris said earlier, I think off air, they're dated.
Yeah, a lot of the jokes, they don't hold up as well. And originally, this film was twice as long, and it had even more duds in it.
I couldn't handle it.
I thought it was a bit too long.
Basically, Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder, they sat down, and they just did a marathon editing session and got it as tight as they wanted it to be, basically.
Right, and somehow Marty Feldman came out on top of that pile, because he really does have the highest ratio of jokes that are funny.
Just his facial cues and stuff like that, it just cracks me up the way he looks.
His delivery, his comedic timing is perfect. His facial expressions are great. He has these bulging eyes. And Marty Feldman's like one of those guys. He's dead now. He died in the 80s. But he's one of those guys that he was either going to be a homeless maniac or a comedic actor.
He has a very distinct look.
Yeah. He has light bulb eyes.
Yeah.
And he looks like a creep, but he's so funny.
Oh, yeah.
And he's just so smart at He knows how to deliver comedy.
He's such a good comedian that a lot of his jokes in this film, they're the worst type of jokes, and they kill every single one of them.
The first time you see him on screen, when he goes, walk like this.
Yeah, walk this way. Yeah. And then he
hands him the cane and makes him walk
that's
like
such
that.
A, like, on paper, that is such a dumb joke, but it works so well.
But see, I love stupid thing. I love stupid humor.
I do,
where
too,
it's just silly and nonsensical. And
I love it when it's done right, because as we talked about earlier, Dumb and Dumber 2 is stupid humor and it doesn't work at all.
Right, because it's done with venom.
Right.
And this film, there's nothing mean about these jokes. It's just silly for the sake of silliness.
Yeah. Right.
And it gets right to the core of the humor, where it's just, this is nonsensical. Laugh along with us.
Like right after that, the werewolf, and then he's like, "They're wolf."
Like, why are you talking like that?
Their castle.
I thought you wanted to. That's another dumb joke, and it works.
Jokes like that every week on this very podcast.
Yes.
We need Marty Feldman in here.
Well, we'll get to work on
that. Next best thing. Yeah. We have Davey Costa.
He's got the same googly eyes.
Let me get the vacuum cleaner and suck him out a little bit.
All right, so aside from Marty Feldman's fantastic performance as Igor, because, you know.
I would like to highlight Madeline Kahn as Elizabeth. She's also...
she's not in this enough.
She's also another actress who has passed away, unfortunately, but Madeline Kahn was incredibly talented, and she's in Blazing Saddles as well.
Yeah.
And she's just...
She plays Elizabeth in this, Dr. Frankenstein's fiance.
Yeah, and she's just...
She's a crazy person.
She's just ridiculous.
She has a mental illness, and she doesn't want to touch Frankenstein. So they rub elbows in the very first scene where he says goodbye to her instead of kissing her.
She's a very broad sort of performance, but it works.
It's a prude character that...
Yeah,
and until she gets...
Yeah, until she basically has sex with the monster, who has a giant dick, because he's a giant.
It's a schwatzer.
And she falls in love with him.
Which is a rape scene played for laughs.
It is, but it's sort of okay, I guess.
It's also 1974. Hey, if you want to see rape played for laughs, why don't you watch Yellowbeard, another film connected to Mel Brooks starring Madeline Kahn.
And there's
there's plenty of rape jokes.
That movie's terrible. Yes. Anyway, so back to this good movie. Madeline Kahn is great. I really liked. It's not her performance isn't as good as Madeline Kahn's, but I liked Terry Garr as Inga. It's a little less nuanced performance. It relies too heavily on look at her goofy
her
accent.
Boobies.
Yeah, she's gorgeous in this
she's
film.
She's so
like,
gorgeous.
Her face is beautiful, and
then she got cursed by a cave troll again.
Time has not been kind to any of these people.
Yeah, she's that typical like German.
The cave troll's name, by the way, is Gene Wilder. I don't know if any of you have seen him lately.
Yeah, he has not aged as well. Yeah.
Ooh, he looks like a...
He looks like John Adams now, I believe.
He looks like a potato that was left in a cave.
Wait, he looks like the same way John Adams looks now?
Yeah. The way John Adams' corpse looks today is how Gene Wilder looks.
He looks like that shot of Hans von Frankenstein in the coffin.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, another great scene where... Yeah. Is that Igor stealing the diary?
No, it's the old man who brings Frankenstein. Can I just say, when I was a kid, that scene scared the hell out of
it's me. It's a skeleton. It's a skeleton in a suit, right?
Yeah, it's like a skeleton because the coffin lid flies open. And when I was a kid, that terrified
but
me.
That's the opening scene. And it's a beautiful shot where the camera just keeps creeping into the room.
Yeah, like, clock ticking.
And then the coffin rips open and there's a skeleton in a suit grasping this diary. And a pair of hands just come from nowhere and try and pull the diary out of this skeleton's cold dead hands, and it won't let go.
Yeah, it keeps pulling it back.
I loved it. Yeah. I loved it. I was laughing from that scene forward.
And then we have Cloris Leachman as Frau Blücher, which
I don't really. I'm not a big fan of this.
You don't like that?
This character? No. A lot of people like this character and find it funny. Not big on it.
It's not the best. I will say her performance during the scene where she's basically laying out the entire plot while playing a violin, I think, is hilarious. It just kills me the way it's filmed.
It doesn't work for me.
It just keeps cutting back between her and Gene Wilder. And every time it cuts back to her character, she strikes another note on the violin. And then that's just so silly. I love it. And
yeah, I felt she was an unnecessary character in the film. Like, yeah, the plot could have worked. Speaking of unnecessary characters, though,
well,
What's
the character's name?
Inspector Kemp. Gadget.
Oh. Inspector Kemp. Yeah, it might as well be Matthew Broderick as Inspector Gadget. the character's necessary. This comedic device that they use, this character has a wooden arm that just won't stop acting up, and it's supposed to be funny, but it's the most tedious thing.
I like it.
I hate it. I hate this.
That they go to it no matter what.
It's incessant. It's a joke that they keep going back to, and it didn't work for me the first time, and it really didn't work for me when the arm started really acting up.
I'll agree that it's definitely hammered into the ground, but there's some points where I think it's funny. I think the whole dart scene is very funny.
I like the dart scene. Just because it had like an old Universal feeling to that scene.
Well, the arm thing is a direct reference to Son of Frankenstein. Yeah. There's a character in that film, his name is like Inspector Clavel or something, and he's played by Basil Rathbone.
Oh, okay.
And he has a false arm because when he was a younger cop, the monster ripped his arm off.
All right, that makes a lot more sense.
And so that's what they're deliberately parodying, because there's a lot of, it's not as pronounced in Son of Frankenstein, but there's a lot of scenes where that character is constantly having to like move his own arm because he has a fake arm. And that's
never mind then, because if I knew that, I probably would have thought this was funny.
Okay.
Just the fact that I was ignorant to that kind of made this be like,
can we go back and cut that part?
Yeah, go ahead.
we'll be like, remember in Son of Frankenstein?
I can say, if I knew that, I would have found this funny, and I'm sure audiences did find this funny because of that knowledge.
Were there other jokes you missed?
Oh, I'm sure there were tons.
There's a scene where he pulls up, when they pull up the Transylvania station, and he says to the boy,
that's a parody of an old, old song where it's like, is this the Chattanooga Choo Choo? It's like a song from the 1920s.
I did not get this joke.
A lot of people
won't
know. I know this stuff because I know really dumb bullshit floating around my head.
That's a lot of that borscht belt humor.
Yeah, it's like old man humor, which I love for some reason, but it's
because you're 86.
Yeah, I'm going to get me my soup, Dave.
Mel Brooks, he grew up during the Great Depression.
He grew up during the Civil War, I believe.
So, yeah, I mean, he...
Brother versus brother.
He references a lot of old,
there's
old
a lot of
stuff.
Old,
yeah, I could just tell in that scene, I was like, why is this in the movie? It makes no sense. It's 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Right, and I can understand that audiences in the 70s probably would have gotten this.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this, we are... What?
So it would be like a Britney Spears joke now.
We're 40 years removed, right?
Yeah, it came out in 74. Yeah. So
how far are we removed from the joke? Like a decade, a century? I mean,
probably 100 years. Yeah. It's probably a 100-year-old joke.
So that said, even though there's a lot of jokes that don't hit their mark, probably because of the time has really been cruel in this film. there are so many jokes that do hit their mark.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I wanted to say Mel Brooks, I listened to a Q&A with Mel Brooks about Young Frankenstein, and he said that it's kind of like a love letter to the the Frankenstein, the original Frankenstein that he watched when he was a kid, about 5 years old. He went to the movies himself and was scared to death.
Right.
But he said back then they showed movies for, you know, about a year. So
yeah.
He just kept going back to watch Frankenstein over and over, and eventually he became his pal. So he was really indebted to the Frankenstein monster. So this and it really shows through in this film. This is a real love letter.
Oh, absolutely. To those movies and just the character.
Yeah.
And I
love it.
And we should talk about the character of the monster played by Peter Boyle.
Yeah.
Which it's a great physical performance. There's a lot of physical humor.
And Peter Boyle had a storied career, but he really, I mean, he's dead. He's another dead one.
Yeah. A lot of people in this movie are dead.
He really rose to prominence later in life as the father on Everybody Loves Raymond.
Right.
And he might be one of two funny actors on that show.
Yeah. And
wow. I won't tell you who the other one is, though. It's a mystery.
This was always the role I knew him from, just because when I was a kid, I probably watched this movie a dozen times. So this was always, when I thought of Peter Boyle, I always thought of him in this film. And Taxi Driver, he's in that, too.
Yes, yeah, that's right. He plays the other taxi guy.
He plays the talking taxi.
Who framed Roger Rabbit. Yeah.
But it's Peter Boyle is great as the monster, and he's great both when he's the hulking, brainless monster, and then I love him when he's the sophisticated monster who can just talk and just that whole ending speech he gives where the villagers come in to basically kill Dr. Frankenstein, and Peter Boyle delivers this sort of touching, passionate speech about why Dr. Frankenstein isn't a bad guy. And
because
it's so well done.
Because Dr. Frankenstein, in the climax of the film, he gives a little of his genius to the monster.
Right. Yeah.
And so
transference.
Instead of being this bumbling fool idiot, the monster can now, you know, speak eloquently.
And that's just, that itself is just a joke on its own. Just
because he's reading the Wall Street Journal in the final scene in bed with Madeline Kahn.
Right. So, yeah.
And while she's telling him that poopy undies go in this bag.
It's like, I put a hamper in this.
He's reading the Wall Street Journal, but he's still shitting his underwear, which is just, it's hilarious.
That's what I like about this movie, because even though it's like a love letter and it takes Frankenstein, like the original, seriously in telling that plot, it also adds these little scenes that make no sense on their own. Like the brain department scene is one of my favorite scenes of the movie.
God, that's funny.
And it makes no sense. What the fuck is a brain deposit?
Yeah.
It's like,
yes, that's where Igor is originally sent to fetch the brain of a genius.
But he drops it.
He drops it. So he just takes the brain of a murderer.
An abnormal brain that's just sitting there.
Is that what it says? It says abnormal?
It says abnormal.
It says abnormal. It says later, do not use.
Oh, and that's where the Abby normal comes.
Yeah, because he says, whose brain was it? And he says, Abby somebody.
But just the fact that it's labeled do not use, as if somebody is using these brains for
and that's
things.
The stupid humor that I love, and that's why I picked Mel Brooks for the director series, because I wanted to touch some movies with just dumb, silly humor.
Mel Brooks, I would say, is one of the few comedy directors who can be thought of as a great director. There's something about comedy.
Oh yeah, he has a technique to him.
There's something about comedy that doesn't lend itself to, like, when I think of great filmmakers, I very rarely think of a comedic filmmaker. There's just something about that.
Well, that's because the comedy genre usually relies on the performances and the written material.
That's true. Yeah,
the visuals don't necessarily have to be great. It's usually just a point and shoot type deal.
Yeah, it's just like a delivery system for jokes.
Unless you're somebody like
the Coen Brothers,
Woody Allen.
Yeah, okay.
He knows what to do with a. I mean, I'm not a Woody Allen champion, but he does know how to frame
a
film.
Yeah,
obviously.
He's a filmmaker. He's not just a guy shooting comedies.
Mel Brooks almost makes exclusively these satire parody movies.
Yeah. Right.
I can't think of any of them that are shot.
The only one I can think of would be like the Zucker Brothers back when they were good, who made, you know, the airplane movies.
Yeah.
Like their early films are good. Even the first Naked Gun movie, I would say, is funny. And then eventually they became horrible.
Sour.
So,
what about what's his name? Who did like Adam McKay? Is that his name?
For Adam McKay,
yeah, Zoolander. Did he do that?
I don't
like those movies. Aren't horrible looking.
Adam McKay did Anchorman, and Step Brothers, and stuff like that. Those are okay.
You know what? I'll say that those are filmed from a
definitely Anchorman,
a comedy expert's point of view. Like, everything is filmed the way it is because it's funny the way it looks.
Yeah.
So I'll say, Adam McKay is definitely in that league.
I mean, Ben Stiller directed Zoolander. Never mind.
Whoops. Even Ben Stiller, while I don't think he's a great director, he at least tries to make his movies look like movies. He puts effort into them.
Yeah.
Like The Cable Guy, which we have an article about on cutprintfilm.com.
We do.
That's not just a comedy. That he put actual effort into making that a film. And there's just something to be said about that. Because when I think of modern comedy filmmakers, I think of Judd Apatow, who everyone loves. And I don't think he's... Even though I liked 40-Year-Old Virgin when I saw it, those movies, they're not well-directed. He's a point-and-shoot director.
Yeah. I forget who wrote this tweet. It was a film critic, and I, for some reason, I'm blanking on his name. But he, after seeing the screening of Horrible Bosses 2, he said, "Did anybody else notice that this film looked like it was shot on an iPhone?" And he's right. And that's what the 40-Year-Old Virgin looks like.
Right.
It looks like it was shot on a phone. And it doesn't matter how it was shot because the jokes are all that matters.
Yeah, and that's a funny movie. I mean, it was when I was whatever.
It's a fine movie.
But there's no artistry into it. And that's, I think, is why we're so
That was his first movie, right? He gets more of a flair as he goes along.
I would say no. I say most of his movies, they all sort of... They have that same sort of point and shoot.
Visually, they do absolutely nothing.
Visually boring movies. Anyone could have shot that sort of film.
I would definitely say Adam McKay is more technically.
Yeah, he's definitely more technically proficient.
Yeah,
and
James Franco, he's a great director.
No, he's not.
You stop it right now.
And just I want to talk.
I'll pull your teeth out one by one.
I want to talk about the music in this film, which I think is gorgeous. Yeah. I love that the violin suite, I guess you would call it, that plays.
Beautiful.
It's a beautiful. And
yeah.
That's another thing. When I think of comedies now, I can't think of a comedy that has a great musical score that's a modern comedy. And it just goes to saying so much about Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, Guardians of the Galaxy would be the closest thing.
But that's not a score. I'm talking about a memorable score for a comedy. I can't think of a modern one. I mean, Ghostbusters has a memorable score, but that's not a modern film. I mean, so it just, they don't make movies like this, especially comedies like this anymore.
Well, they don't make anything like this anymore.
No.
Watching this was kind of a mind fuck because you're just like, this is gorgeous. It's black and white. It's hitting all of the classic notes while doing something completely original.
Yeah.
Which is what's cool about it, which that's what gives it its value.
Absolutely.
But I would love somebody to do something like this. And I guess the closest thing would be maybe like Inherent Vice or Wes Anderson does.
Yeah.
Like the way it captures a nostalgia.
I mean, I guess you could say Tarantino sort of does that with his films. I mean, his films are all him stealing from other filmmakers, basically, but in a loving way.
Mel Brooks went to Warner Brothers, I think, first with the idea for Young Frankenstein.
And their Warner sister, Dot.
Yes. Yakko and Wacko and Dot were all present in the meeting.
And the hollow nurse was there.
And he pitched this film to them, and they loved it. They loved it, and he said, all right, great. We'll be in touch. We'll get those papers over to you. And he said, as he was walking out the door, he said, oh, yeah, and it's going to be in black and white. And he walked out the door. And they said, whoa, come back. So he had to come back, and they said, no, we're not doing this in black and white. What we can do is we'll film it in color, and then we'll desaturate it so that it can be shown both ways. And he said, no, because when you do it that way, then black looks like blue, and it looks terrible. So they said, no, we're not going to do it. He said, okay, see you later. And then he went to Fox, and they gave him everything he wanted. And thank God, because if this weren't filmed in true black and white, I'm not interested.
No, me neither.
Yeah, it would not – like. I've seen set photos, and the set photos are in color, and it just looks wrong.
Oh, I'm going to look them up.
Because, like, the monster is, they actually put the makeup on the monster, and they did this with the old Universal films, too. They paint the monster a sort of bluish green, and that's just so it'll show up as pale in black and white. And it looks weird when you see them in color, and it would not have the same effect it does.
Yeah, it just looks so authentic, and it if you didn't know... You would think that you were watching a Universal monster.
Yeah, if you were just flipping channels and this was on like TCM one day, you would think, oh, this is an old Universal, and then you would realize, never mind.
Never mind, Gene Wilder's screaming.
And his hair is insane.
The only thing I gotta say that I didn't like was I think the film drags in the middle.
It gets a little. Oh, we have to talk about Gene Hackman. who we didn't bring up at all. Which
okay, well,
should.
That would be the middle of the film.
Okay.
And that's the only bright spot in the middle of the film okay. for me.
But yeah, so yeah, go back. What just dragged to you about the middle?
I guess after the scene that I played where Victor Frankenstein has his freak out.
Right.
From that point to when he tap dances with the monster, yeah. it is just a bore to me.
Think so.
That is the area where most of the jokes don't land. Mm-hmm. We don't see a whole lot of Igor, so there's not much.
Yeah.
He's not doing much. It's more Gene Wilder and Terry Garr right. and not Madeline Kahn, Cloris Leachman.
Cloris Leachman.
And she's my – oh, and the inspector.
Right.
It's those four. And it's just – it doesn't work for me. It just drags. It drags yeah. on and on and on.
And that's where it deviates most from, like, the traditional Frankenstein story, too.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
That could be what it is.
But in that darkness, we do get this bright spot where the monster, he's on the loose.
Yes.
And
again, this is a direct parody of yeah. scenes from the Universal films.
Yes, he visits the little girl, and I liked it when he visits the little girl.
Oh my
girl.
God!
You think he's going to throw her down the well?
I love the way he sits on a seesaw and she flies through the air and lands in bed, and then is magically covered by her covers.
I will say that made me laugh because that just brought me back to the Three Stooges.
Yeah, it's so ridiculous because it's not just that she flies into bed; it's that the covers cover her. That's what makes it so ridiculous.
And then after he visits this little girl that he would have killed in the original
yeah,
film.
Yeah, because she says, oh, we're out of flowers. What do we do now? And Peter Boyle does this thing where he shifts his eyes from side to side, and that's such a corny Keystone Cops kind yeah. of joke, but it works so well, just the way he does it.
So then he visits a hermit
right.
played by superstar Gene Hackman.
Yeah, a blind hermit who's all alone.
Who was already famous at this time.
Yeah.
He had done the French famous. Connection... already.
And at the time, this was an uncredited cameo, so no one knew yeah. he was going to be
in the
movie.
Matt Damon of this film?
Yeah, yes. he was the Matt Damon of this film.
So he asked Mel Brooks, hey, I would really like to be in this.
Yeah.
I don't care if I'm given any name drop or anything like that. I just want to be a part of it. So he wrote him into the hermit role, and he's great.
It's all physical stuff where he just keeps, because he's blind, he just keeps pouring soup onto the monster's lap and laying the monster's thumb on it. It's just, it's so silly, but it's so great. And
yes, he decides to have a cigar and then lights Peter Boyle's thumb yeah. on fire.
And then the
which is the second flaming finger joke of yeah. the movie.
And the kicker to this whole scene is, and Gene Hackman improvised this line. Basically, the monster runs from the room just screaming because he's tired of getting hurt. And so Gene Hackman comes out and he says, I was going to make espresso. And while you watch that scene, it fades to black. And the reason it faded to black is because that line was improvised, after he said it, everyone on set started laughing. So they had to fade the scene out or else they wouldn't be able to use it.
There was a lot of that going on, right. especially with Marty Feldman.
Yeah, I read that a lot of the stuff was improvised.
Oh, most of his stuff was improvised.
Everything with like the hump is improvised.
And people had to
shifting sides.
Yeah.
People would have to leave the studio because they couldn't get a good take when he would say something that surprised them.
God, I just wish love I could be there for
like
something.
Yeah, just
like
to
that.
Like be a fly yeah. on the wall, basically, when they were just filming this. And I read this too, that they were having so much fun making the film that as it got to the end of shooting, Mel Brooks started writing additional scenes just so they wouldn't have to stop making the movie. And like that's like an adorable story
yeah.
to me.
Yeah,
it's like an adventure.
Yeah, like we have to keep making this movie. We're having so much fun,
and it looks like everybody's having fun. Too.
Yeah, you can just tell that
there's
having
a joy in everybody's eyes.
Yeah, unlike Dumb and Dumber 2, where everyone they feel like they're being held at gunpoint to make this film.
All right, well, I think we did it justice.
I really did like this film. Aside from the middle act where it drags, there are still, like we said, there's bright spots. The girl flying through the window and being yeah. covered up by nothing.
And I think that's true of pretty much any comedy you can there are very few perfect comedies. I think like Ghostbusters is like the one perfect yeah. comedy I can think of. And maybe like older, like Cary Grant comedy. Like there's a movie called Bringing a Baby with Cary Grant and... Catherine Hepburn, where they're raising a tiger, and that movie is ridiculous, but that's a perfect comedy.
And I'd say Chaplin's Modern Times.
Yeah, like the older stuff, but so any comedy, you're going to have hit or miss jokes, but this film, it hits far more than it misses.
Agreed. I agree.
Yeah, it's very rapid fire, but the ones that miss, they you it isn't too long until a better joke.
Yeah, like there are there's so many jokes that you instantly forget whatever bombed, and you're just on to the next one.
And there's stuff you laugh at that you like that surprised me that I was laughing at it, like stuff that I wouldn't think was normally
like
funny.
What?
Like the horses, how they kept saying
every time they say her name, the horses, because like they, I love that joke because they never give it up, and that's what makes it, because they'll be miles away from the horses and you'll just hear them scream from far away.
Like, and that's so dumb, and it shouldn't make me laugh, but the scene where he's in the bedroom saying goodnight to her, when he says it and you hear them outside, I'm just like, it killed me. All right, I'm done.
All right.
You so done?
Shall we recommend some movies?
Let's hold hands.
Let's hold hands.
Movies. Pick the movies. Pick the movies. Pick the movies.
All right.
Ooh, that is a full 38 seconds long. Good
get a full
God.
Chorus in
my
there.
Favorite part is when it doesn't change.
Man, I hope everyone enjoyed that.
Well, why record four different ones when you could just copy and paste the same vocals over and over?
Hey, it worked for me. Yeah, I enjoyed that immensely.
That'll go on the greatest hits CD.
All right. Who wants to recommend a movie?
I'll go first.
Okay.
Mine's very topical. Very atopical. Let me rub this on you real quick.
Yeah, please. I have a rash.
I'm going to recommend, it's not a movie.
Oh.
Yeah, well, you sort of missed the point.
Did you forget that's his weekly movie recommendations?
It's a book.
I probably should have looked up when this came out.
It's a new type of ketchup that you're recommending.
Yeah, it's the green ketchup. Have you guys seen it? It's ketchup, but it's green.
So I went and saw this in the theaters back in 2011. It's a National Theater production of Frankenstein.
Oh, is this the one? All right, go on.
Directed by Danny Boyle.
I wanted to see this.
Starring Benedict Cumberbatch and, what's the other guy's name?
Johnny Lee Miller.
Yeah, they both play Sherlock, which is a coincidence. But so there were two versions of this. It was a stage play that was filmed at the National Theater. It was live and opened there. But every night they would switch the roles. Cumberbatch would play Frankenstein and Johnny Lee Miller would play the monster, and then switch. So I saw the version where Benedict Cumberbatch was Dr. Frankenstein, and Johnny Lee Miller was fucking amazing as the monster. This is the best by far.
I really wanted to see this. I just never got around to it.
Was it better than De Niro?
Oh, man, that movie.
This is the best thing related to Frankenstein that I've ever seen. The best production of it.
Even better than Frankenhooker?
And
a great film and a great opening scene.
Or Billy the Kid versus Frankenstein.
Oh, maybe not that. But just, Johnny Lee Miller is so good as the monster that when I saw, like, when I went back and watched because there's like trailers you can watch of Benedict Cumberbatch playing the monster, he's not as good.
He just seems like he'd be a better Dr. Frankenstein.
He's so good as Dr. Frank. That's the thing, is that they fit those roles. Yeah. And when you switch them, it's kind of like off. But it's so cool the way they did it.
Yeah, I wish they would like release this somewhere because I wanted to see it.
Yeah, so I didn't know. Apparently it re-releases in some theaters every now and then.
Yeah.
I was just in Princeton last weekend and they were playing it there, which is what reminded me of it. But I'm sure you can find it.
Like a bootleg, if you will.
Somewhere.
Yeah.
So this is kind of like when Van Halen toured with Sammy Hagar and David Lee Roth, and every night they would switch who sung
exactly.
for
exactly.
And you just have to talk to the right guy in the parking lot to get the cassette tapes.
That's right.
Yeah. So, and Danny Boyle does a cool job. I'm not the biggest Danny Boyle fan.
I don't really care for Danny Boyle.
But for a stage production, this was cool. It's a lot of sweeping camera movements and stuff that I wasn't expecting.
That's nice.
And it's the stage is just this one simple circle. It's not. There's not a lot to it. Yeah. It's just the characters, which was awesome.
Yeah. All right.
So the National Theater Live Frankenstein.
Okay, I'll go. My pick this week is It's on HBO Go. It's a documentary. I'm doing the documentary this week, Dave.
Oh, what a jerk.
Now you know how it feels.
Yes, this is a 2013 movie directed by Tim Donahue. Don't even bother looking him up. He hasn't done much. He has a couple things in production, but well, the jury's out on you, Tim. This is a movie called Casting By. Ooh. And it's
oh, I've seen this.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
It's a documentary that focuses on the role of the casting director in Hollywood. And it primarily focuses on a woman named Marion Dougherty, who, once the Hollywood studio system collapsed in the 60s, really upped the ante out in New York for picking the right actor for the role rather than the tradition, the Hollywood tradition of typecasting, where they say, oh, this guy played a doctor in this film. He's a good doctor. He'll play a doctor in this film.
Hitchcock is what's the word I'm looking for? He's very known for doing that thing you're talking about.
Well, yeah, studios used to have like the
notorious.
A studio system where basically actors were owned by the studio.
Right.
They just said, "Oh, we own this actor's contract. Put him in your movie."
So even if this actor or actress was not right for the role, they would just put her in the role anyway.
That's why, like, a lot of old films, you'll get a lot of stiff actors who are just, like, up on the screen. You're just like, this guy sucks.
And that's why I'm not a giant fan of Hollywood films prior to 1960, because they have that stiff acting. I much prefer French films.
Apparently,
there was a
logic to that where they didn't have to waste exposition time, because, like, if it was a Machiavellian star,
right. No,
like,
there's logic to it, and it makes sense, but you don't get great performances.
No, not at all.
And so Casting By shines a light on that, saying that the casting director is an integral and such an important part of the filmmaking process that still doesn't get any credit. There's no Oscar for casting director, and they won't even call them directors for some films.
Yeah, I remember.
Oh, wow.
There's a big point of contention about the casting director even being referred to as a director.
There's an interview in this movie with Taylor Hackford, and he comes off
like
a huge asshole.
He's a piece of trash.
Yeah.
Is Nina Gold in this at all? Because she does all of HBO's casting, and she's great.
I don't think she's in
this.
She's
fucking fantastic. I mean, just think about HBO shows. She does almost all of them, and they're all cast fucking amazing.
Yeah, and there's interviews with Al Pacino, John Lithgow, John Voight, Martin Scorsese. He's a casting director. And just a laundry list of other famous people speaking high praise for casting directors. And it's also a role that's primarily filled by women. It's a women's...
That's strange.
And that's very odd, but... I think that plays a big part in why...
We gotta fix that.
Why, well, yeah. Yeah.
Those women, they have it too good.
Too much misandry going on here. I think that's a big part of why it's not given respect by the Academy. I think that's a major part, because
I'm sure it absolutely is.
I think it also might have to do with, like, the fact that the director usually picks, like, the guy he wants for the script.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That one guy. But... character actors and stuff like that's all the kit. Like, we were just talking about Peter Boyle in Taxi Driver. There's no way Scorsese cast him for that
role. Yeah, out of nowhere. Like, Peter Boyle would be great.
Ultimately, the director says yes or no, but he didn't find that person.
Yeah.
He didn't even know who that person was, probably, if they were an unknown.
Watch, we're going to be so wrong. Him and Peter Boyle are, like, best friends.
Yeah. But, yeah, so...
They're roommates, I believe.
It's a fascinating documentary. It's really good. It's really well done. It's called Casting By, and it's on HBO Go, and it came out in 2013.
Uber, Uber!
Chris?
Yes. So, I was going to recommend this last week, but I didn't, just because I wanted to recommend Solaris to keep with the Interstellar theme. But this film stars Matthew McConaughey. It was also an Interstellar. It is 2011's Killer Joe, and it is directed by William Friedkin, who also directed The Exorcist and The French Connection. This is a brutal, brutal, but very darkly funny movie. And Emile Hirsch plays a young man. He's sort of like a white trash guy living in the South. And he's broke, and he owes people some money. So he decides, along with his father and his stepmother. His father is played by Thomas Hayden Church.
Oh, I like him.
Yeah, and his stepmother is played by Gina Gershon. And they decide, basically...
I like him, too.
They decide to put a contract out on Emile Hirsch's real mother and collect the insurance money from her death. So they hire a hitman who's also a cop, and the hitman's known as Killer Joe, and he's played by Matthew McConaughey, who is fucking phenomenal in this movie. And so Matthew McConaughey, he doesn't really want payment. What he wants, basically, is he wants the family to give him the youngest daughter, played by Juno Temple, just basically as his sex slave, if you will. And she's sort of like an airhead. She's sort of like, it's not really hinted, I don't really say, but you could think she's sort of like mentally deficient, okay, basically. And she's sort of like this sweet, innocent girl who doesn't know any better. And they and so Killer Joe and Juno Temple's character, his name's Dottie, they develop this sort of weird, almost sweet relationship, but not quite. And it's just, it's a brutal, it's one of the most brutal films I've ever, I don't want to spoil it, but there's basically a 20-minute sequence at the end of the film, which is just nonstop violence just going on and on.
I am going to watch
this.
Yeah,
me too.
I've only seen it listed, I thought, well, this, the name of this movie sounds absurdly bad. I will not watch it.
Mighty Joe. Mighty Joe Young.
McConaughey is so good. It's a scary performance because his character is just basically just this unrelenting psychopath, basically.
It's odd that it's a sequel to Contact.
Yeah.
Is this Meet Joe Black?
Yeah, exactly. I'm just going to say yes to every right. title you said.
I
just
looked this up, and we're doing some great improv.
There's some naughty pictures of Juno Temple. No, so
that's not where I thought you were going. I don't care.
She is a cutie. But yeah, there's I so much want to talk about this last scene of the film, but I can't give it away because it's a spoiler. But so if you at home watch Killer Joe, tweet at us what you thought of the ending sequence, because it's really brutal.
And tweet us what you're snacking on right now.
Yes.
We really want to know.
Show us the chip and dip.
If you're just tuning in, you failed.
Yeah, I don't.
Something's wrong with your OS. I think you need to roll back to the previous version.
Your Stitcher player is malfunctioning.
Squarespace.
No, we don't. We're not okay. Advertising.
We're
no.
not.
No, not yet.
Well, what are we advertising?
I don't know. Why don't you tell us, Chris?
Well, I have a book. It's called The House on Creep Street, and you can find it on Amazon.com. So won't you go and buy it?
Won't you?
Please.
You should.
Also, there are some other websites you can check out. What are they?
Cutprintfilm.com.
Yes, cutprintfilm. Yes, Google. Google.com.
Huffington Post.
The all-new and improved cutprint.
Cutprintfilm.com.
Please, yeah, go check out the website. Check out our new...
Taste like meat. That's our new slogan.
Check out our new design. Let us know what you think of it. I think it's gorgeous. And
I do, too. Yeah.
Tweet us. Say, hey, guys, that design looks great.
You're obsessed with the tweeting.
Yeah.
Why doesn't anybody MySpace us?
Oh, Google Plus.
Add me as your friend on MySpace.
Look,
I'm the only one using it.
Oh, also, don't forget our dead journal.
Yes.
And but you can also check out websites like Joystick Jerks.
Yes.
.com.
JoystickJerks.com. They have a podcast. They talk about video games. It's a highly energetic show.
Do they spell jerks with an X?
No, they don't.
They should.
That would be absurd. You can also check out
antifanboy.com.
Did they spell fanboy with an X?
I hope so.
I don't know where they would put the X. I'm sure I have an idea, though. yeah, they do a podcast about comics, video games, comic book movies, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of stuff coming up this week.
Yeah, we got reviews galore,
editorials.
Pussy galore.
No, that's a character from the James Bond film series.
Yeah, we got a bunch of stuff coming up. I can't think of any of it.
sounds riveting.
I will have endorsement.
My Hunger Games review up on Wednesday. So
yes.
So stop by to check that out.
We have some very, very good editorials going up. Yeah, I was editing them before the show.
Every week we get new writers, so come check them out.
Yeah.
I will have an in-depth piece on It's a Wonderful Life going up this week.
Really?
Because Christmas is coming.
It's a little early, I think.
Should I hold that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, why don't you hold this?
Boy, we both couldn't wait to get to that punchline.
Just running to get out of our mouths.
All right, and Gary, the piano-playing robot, is telling me that it's our time to go.
All right, so yeah, check us out. Cutprintfilm.com, at cutprintfilm on Twitter.
Were there any mysteries this week?
No.
Oh, okay. No mysteries. Good night, everybody.
Then.
Bye. Bluka!
With the noses silly, yeah. High hats and arrow collars. White spats and lots of dollars. Spending every dime for a wonderful time.